particularly how Christians should live in the time between when Jesus went to heaven and to when he will return. As we look at chapter 5, we see that Peter continues some of these themes, but there's a bit of a break. He goes on at the beginning of chapter 5 to talk about leadership in the church. Now, when we look at the first verse of chapter 5, we see the word therefore. Now, when I went to NTE in first year uni and went to did strand 1, my strand leader told me that whenever I see the word therefore, I'm to ask, why is it?
Therefore.
Very good. It's good to see some NTE people there. they still teach that. But when we look at this therefore, we might be a bit confused. Normally, when we see the word therefore in the Bible, it's really clear why it's there. But this one might seem a little bit more tricky. It's not immediately obvious. It seems like these two things aren't related. He's been talking about suffering, and now he talked about leadership in the church. Those two things don't seem to be immediately obvious. Now, before we go around and we correct Peter's grammar and we kind of tell him that he should use the full stop instead of the word therefore, it's worth having a bit more of a look. And in fact, if we look towards the end of, in the middle of chapter 5, at around verse 6, we see, again, he starts talking about suffering again. So it's a bit of a suffering sandwich. We've got suffering, leadership in the church, suffering. It's pretty clear that these things are connected. How are they connected? Well, for me, I think that they're connected because if Christians are going to stand up under unjust suffering like Peter has been exhorting them to, if they are going to manage to continue to stay faithful to Jesus despite a world who hates them, then it's not something they're going to be able to do by themselves. But rather, it is something they're going to need to do as a church. You see, friends, the church is not an optional extra in the Christian life. It is at the very core of who we are as Christians. And what's more, the church needs to be functioning well. It needs to be united if we are going to persevere in the face of persecution. Now, often if you look at groups in society that get persecuted, often that persecution can cause that group to just disintegrate, to crumble. If this isn't going to happen to the church, then leadership is important. It is of vital importance. And that's why Peter now speaks to leaders. Because in the church, we need great leaders. Now, in the world, leadership is big business. There are countless books and podcasts and expensive seminars you can go to learn to be a leader. And the reason so much money is spent on leadership training and leadership resourcing is that leadership is recognized as being important. Because leadership is important. Leadership is important to any organization that wants to achieve anything. But leadership is particularly important to the church. And actually, as Peter will tell us, Christian leadership should be quite different from earthly leadership. But before Peter gives us his advice on leadership, he gives us his credentials as a Christian leader, as a leader of leaders. Have a look at verse 1 with me. Therefore, as a fellow elder and witness to the sufferings of the Messiah, and also a participant in the glory about to be revealed, I exhort the elders among you. Peter is saying that he is an elder. So what's an elder? Is Peter saying that he's really old and he's got lots of grey hair and wrinkles? Maybe he's got to get up and go to the toilet all the time at night? No, that's not what Peter's saying. He's not saying he's old. To be an elder isn't to be old. The word elder that we translate in our Bible, it's a word that it means overseer, it means leader. In fact, the denomination that I'm a part of, the Presbyterian Church, loves that word so much we named our whole denomination after it. It's like the word presbyteros in Greek. It means overseer. And this, he appeals as a fellow elder, meaning a leader in the church. He knows what it means to be an elder. And if you want to see what it means to be an elder, there's a number of lists of qualifications of elders in the New Testament, and one in Titus and one in Timothy. Peter is saying that he is an elder. He has done the job of those who he's writing to, so he understands what it means to be a leader of God's people in a local congregation. But we can see that that isn't his only qualification. He says that he's been a witness of the sufferings of Christ. Now, if you want to read a bit about Peter's relationship with Jesus, have a look through one of the Gospels. You can see that Peter was one of Jesus' inner circle. Peter was one of the people who was right there with Jesus, often saying something silly. That was Peter's role in the Gospels. But he understood what Jesus went through. Now, he and all the other blokes, all our male disciples, bugged out before they actually saw the crucifixion. They all wussed off and ran away. So he didn't actually get to see that. But he was there. He was a witness to the resurrection. And he really was a witness to the suffering, the wider sufferings of Christ. And what's more important is that Jesus commissioned him to be a witness to the rest of the world. Jesus commissioned him to take that message of the gospel to everybody, everywhere. That's why he's saying when he says that he is a witness. So we can see that he has great qualifications, great credentials to say what he's about to say. So having heard Peter's credentials to speak with authority about Christian leadership, what's his advice? Well, let's keep reading verses 2 and 3. Shepherd God's flock among you, not overseeing out of compulsion, but freely, according to God's will. Not for the money, but eagerly. Not lording it over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. How are Christian leaders, how are Christian elders meant to lead? Well, they are meant to lead as shepherds. You know, the people who kind of follow sheep around. Now, these aren't the sort of sheep shepherds who, you know, round sheep up with helicopters and motorbikes, like we see in Australia. These are the kind of shepherds who use the shepherd's crook and lead the sheep, like the kind of shepherds we saw in the first century. It means guiding the sheep, driving the sheep, protecting the sheep. And they're to lead the congregation of God's people in a way that isn't lording it over them, but leading by example, correcting gently. Now, I don't think this means that Christian leaders can't rebuke wayward sheep. I don't think this means that Christian leaders can't lead from the front, both of which we see shepherds doing. But rather, I think the big difference between a worldly leader and a Christian leader is one of attitude. For leaders in business, politics, or really any other human field, what is the goal of leadership? It is often to get the most productivity out of the group of people they're leading. And this often looks like making the most money, achieving certain objectives, getting a project done on time and under budget. And often, for the worldly leader, there is a payoff for them in being able to do this. They might get more money for being able to do this well, more prestige, more power. Now, I don't like to mention Donald Trump's name in public, because it seems that every time people mention his name, he just gets more powerful. I'm not sure what's happening there. But Donald Trump, who is his own best evangelist, will tell you that he will make a great president because he is a great leader. And his evidence for this is how much money he has made, what great buildings he has constructed. And he wants to be very clear about the buildings he's constructed because he writes his name on all of them. You see, for Donald Trump, the final assessment of his leadership talent and his leadership skill is the sheer output he's managed to produce. I think Donald Trump is the epitome of a worldly leader. But friends, this is not how a Christian leader is meant to behave. Christian leaders shouldn't look at Donald Trump and say, "Man, I'd like to be like that guy." And the way that Christian leadership is different fundamentally comes down to motivation, and it comes down to attitude, as I said. You see, Christian leaders are not to lead out of compulsion or for money. They're not to lead for the thrill of ordering people around. Now, these things are a temptation for Christian leaders, just like they are for secular leaders. Now, when it comes to money, we do pay Christian leaders, myself included. But those of us who get paid to do ministry should remember that we're not actually getting paid to do ministry. I get paid a stipend, not a salary. If you want to see what the differences between those are, look them up on Wikipedia. A stipend is a living allowance. I'm not being paid directly for doing work. Which is why we should never consider doing what some churches, and I think the US and other places have done, is giving their pastors performance pay. You know, if you grow the church by another 100 people, we'll give you another $10,000 a year or something like that. That's just ridiculous. Because it should never be about the money. Rather, the church supports me and supports other Christian workers so that we can do ministry full time. Now, I heard an example of this, which is just horrible. I heard of an old minister who hated his church, and his church hated him. But he couldn't leave because he's waiting for his superannuation to mature. It's just ridiculous, isn't it? That should never, ever be the case. We should never be doing ministry for money. But I think that's not that big a trap for us. Maybe it is for those like me who work in churches. But for every single one of us, I think the bigger trap is glory. I think this is a trap that I've fallen into many times. That we see ourselves and our identity so caught up in our position that we forget that we're doing it for God. We're just so obsessed with ourselves and our glory that we forget that what we're doing should be for God. You see, it doesn't really matter what your position is. It could be organizing the cleaning roster at church, right through being the archbishop of some massive denomination. We shouldn't be doing it for our own glory. We should be doing it for God's glory, for God's significance. Along with that, we shouldn't be leaders just because we enjoy telling other people what to do. I think that's a big trap. I've seen people who are youth group leaders and kids' church leaders, and I've probably been one of those people as well. It's a bit of a kick to tell people what to do, isn't it? But that's not why we should be leading God's people at any level of the church. And we need to be careful about this, because Peter makes it clear that as Christian leaders, we too have a boss. We need to be humble because we have a boss in heaven. Have a look at verse 4. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. You see, friends, we will be held accountable for how we have led. Something which haunts me a lot is that I'm going to be held accountable for how I have shepherded the flock that God has given me. We need to remember that it's not just for ministers. If you're teaching Sunday school or leading youth group, or you're leading church as an elder, as a manager, or leading a church of thousands of people, that you are accountable to God for how you lead them. You aren't the boss. God's the boss. He is the chief shepherd, and at any level of Christian leadership, you are just an under-shepherd. And it's his approval we need to seek, not the approval of those who we're leading. It's the glory of God that the glory that God gives that we should desire. Not the glory that might come from being a great worldly leader. We don't want the endorsement of the world. We want God's endorsement, don't we, of our leadership. We want the crown of glory that will never fade. And if we're going to make a stand for Jesus in this world that hates him, then the Christian church is going to need great leaders who can lead God's people with strength, integrity, and with humility. Now, I just want to pause for a moment here and think about Christian leadership, particularly thinking about those who should be doing it. You see, churches everywhere need people to step up into leadership. As a pastor, I'm constantly looking for people who I can rely on as leaders. And indeed, God has been generous to me and generous to our church in providing some great leaders for both of our congregations. But you see, leadership in the local church and indeed in the NCS is vital. And both the church and NCS need people to step up into leadership. And there are two ways that I want to challenge all of you here today to step up into leadership. The first way I want to challenge each of you is to be willing to step up into leadership. Now, I know not everyone can be a leader, but there are many levels that you can lead at. Making a morning tea roster at church is a form of leadership. You see, the church needs great leaders. The church needs leaders who are willing to step up. We need to be careful that we don't do the whole Gen Y thing and keep our options open and not commit and not put our name on a roster or not want to commit to a leadership position. See, we need to commit and we need to step up. Be willing to step up into leadership. And it's not just for low-level leadership positions like making rosters or even leading youth group, that's a low-level leadership position. But as we get older, we need to be willing to sign up for time-consuming leadership positions. You see, churches need great elders. Churches need great Sunday school teachers. Churches need great managers or administrators. Be willing to step up into leadership. because the church needs great leaders. I can testify, having seen numbers of basket case churches and churches around the state, how important good leadership is. And often, if good leaders won't step up into leadership, bad leaders will. All you have to do is see how quickly bad leaders can turn a church towards bad theology and division. It's just incredible. You see, leadership always works. Anyone leading will that will happen. If good leadership can lead a church to gospel effectiveness and relational harmony, then bad leadership can do the opposite. So can I challenge you to be willing to step up to be an elder, a leader, whatever your church calls it? But I want to give you another challenge to step up to as well. I want you to think about perhaps having ministry as your vocation. If we're going to see even a fraction of this city or this country won for Jesus, then we're going to need a stack more full-time pastors and evangelists. In this city of Newcastle alone, we need to just plant a crazy amount of churches. Our church is trying to reach out to Western Newcastle and did some sums. And I reckon I don't know about all of Newcastle, but Western Newcastle, I reckon there's probably between 2 to 3% of people in church on a Sunday. If we're going to get that close to the 20, 30, 40, 100%, we're just going to need a stack more churches. And for that, we're going to need to stack more pastors and quality and people trained to lead churches. So can I challenge you to think about stepping up into full-time vocational ministry? Now, there's lots of great ways to think about this. Have a chat to Martin or Rod or one of the other NCS staff or to me or to your minister at church. And can I challenge you to do a ministry apprenticeship? As Mez is doing and Bootsy did last year and Andy Cox is doing with us. Have a chat to someone who's doing a ministry apprenticeship. Maybe think about doing that. There's a conference in October for people who are thinking about doing ministry apprenticeships. Get along to that. You see, the church needs great leaders. And I want to ask you, can you be one of them? The second way I want to challenge you to step up is to be a leader who makes leaders. Now, my job as a pastor of Restored Church and at Walls End Presby, I see developing new leaders as one of my most important jobs. But this shouldn't just be my job as a pastor. Everyone who is in a leadership position should be trying to make new leaders. If you lead a small group at uni, then pick someone in that small group to train as a leader. If you run a youth group, keep an eye out for kids who you might be able to train to be leaders of the youth group. If you serve watermelon in Toasties at uni, find a first-year NCSer and train them to do that as well. You see, the church needs great leaders, which means leadership training is everyone's job. At NCS, it's not just Martin's job, it's not just the staff's job. Leadership training is everyone's responsibility. Thus ends my rant, and we'll get back to the text. I'll get a drink after that. Now, if we need great leaders, then Peter knows we also need great followers. One of my favourite quotes on leadership is this. What is a leader without followers? Does anyone know the answer? A leader without followers is just a guy taking a walk. You see, we need people who are willing to be led. We need leaders who are willing to submit to higher leadership. If we want to be a church with a united missionary front, then everyone can't just do what they want. We need people who are willing to follow good and godly leadership. So we need to think about how we respond to leadership. I think it's a bit of an Australian thing to kind of cut down tall poppies. You know, we don't like people telling us what to do. We're going right back to the Anzac days. It was the Australians could never be told what to do. And I think in the church, we can sometimes have a bit of that culture as well. But Peter won't have a bar of it. Peter wants Christians who are humble enough to follow. If we need great leaders, then we need people humble enough to follow their lead. Now, I think Peter is pretty smarty in that the first people he addresses with a specific instruction about this is young men. He tells young men in verse 5 to make themselves subject to the elders. And I think he does this because we're young men. I think I can still count myself as a young man. Can I? I think so. Even though Jess thought I was like 45. I'm really not. I think I can still count myself as a young man. As young men, I think we often think we know what's best. We're the ones who know the best way forward, and we want everyone to follow us. And everyone else needs to get out of our way. Now, I feel this. I find this hard to do this. I find it hard to submit to leadership that's over me sometimes. I find myself railing against people who don't really know what they're doing. They should get out of the way and let me do it. But as young men, we really need to submit to good and godly elders. That is something that we really need to do as we continue to lead under other people and as we continue to follow. We need to make sure we are submitting to good and godly elders. Peter then expands out this plea for humility to everyone. He says that we need to clothe ourselves in humility. And I think we need to see this humility working hand in hand with the shepherd leadership of elders. You see, the onus here isn't on the elders to force people to submit to them, but on those who are being led to submit. Do you see how that works? As the elders lead, those who are being led should submit. It's kind of a bit like that husband-wife submission thing that we saw a bit earlier in 1 Peter, and we've seen Ephesians and other places. They are to lead, and those who are being led are to submit. There's no forcing here. It's something that we should each do willingly. You see, humility is the key to living in community, and we need to be humble towards each other. The reason that churches work when many other communities don't is humility. People who are willing to be subject to one another, to be humble. There's actually a warning here for those who refuse to be humble, that God actually opposes the proud and gives grace to the humble. This is something that we all need to take heed of, me particularly. That God doesn't like those who are proud. God doesn't like those who think they can make it on their own. He wants those who are humble, who know they need help, who need grace. So Peter has now, having given us some insights into Christian leadership, having told us how both to be leaders and those who are led, Peter then pivots back to the idea of humility, back to his theme of suffering. You see, we aren't just to have humility to submit to good and godly leadership. But Peter, as he said a number of times through this letter, he wants us in humility to also submit to unjust suffering and persecution. Have a look at verse 6 with me. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that he may exalt you in due time. Can you see the weakness and the strength in this verse? We are to be weak in the face of suffering for being a follower of Jesus. That's hard, isn't it? When people inflict suffering on you, what do you want to do? You want to show them that you're stronger. You want to show them that they're not affecting you. You want to show them that in actual fact, you could beat them. That's what you want to do. But what does Peter say? He says to submit to their harsh treatment, knowing that God is strong. Now, I can imagine, this is an illustration, I can imagine being captured by terrorists would be a pretty horrible thing to go through. I can imagine being in an ISIS prison somewhere would be horrible. But I can imagine, just pretend that you were some important diplomat or something, and the Australian government thought you were valuable enough, and they decided to send an SAS troop in to come and get you. And you knew they were coming. Do you think that would make it easier to submit to their hostility and to their treatment of you, knowing that the door's going to get kicked in at any moment, the SAS is going to come in guns blazing and rescue you? You see, that's knowing that strength is coming helps you be weak, doesn't it? If that's the case with that scenario, how much more is it with us in God? You see, we can be weak in the face of persecution, knowing that God is strong, not just stronger than the SAS, is strength, is in control of everything. That's what makes suffering easy, knowing we can submit, knowing that God is in control, knowing that He is stronger than the one who is oppressing us, knowing that God is the one who will vindicate us by His mighty hand. If this is a fact, then we can draw great comfort. Have a look at verse 7, where Peter says, casting all your care upon him because he cares about you. Now, isn't this verse just such a great encouragement? We don't need to worry about if our concern is too big or too small. Peter says, cast all our anxieties on him because God cares for us so deeply. Now, one of the great joys of my job is every 2 months visiting a lady named Shirley. Shirley must be 90-something in the shade. She can't get out to church anymore, although she was a very faithful church member for decades and decades. And I just love visiting her. In fact, I must admit, when I took this job, the idea of visiting older people in their homes wasn't something I was super excited about. You know, I wanted to change the world. Still do, but anyway. I wanted to change the world. And anyway, I started visiting these older people more out of duty than anything, but I love visiting Shirley because she is just such an encouragement to me. Even though she can hardly keep herself up in her seat, she's in that much pain and that much agony, and she keeps having strokes and it's not going too well at all. But in the midst of all that suffering, just from her physical things, I just told her that we're doing. I always let her know what we're doing at church. And when we were doing 1 Peter at church last year, I just said this, and she grabbed my hand and she said, "Matt, 1 Peter has my favourite verse in the whole Bible in it. I say it to myself every night, every morning when I get out of bed, every morning when I go to bed. It's this verse: cast all your anxiety, cast all your care upon Him, because God cares for you." So that verse keeps me going no matter what is happening. That verse keeps me going every day. That verse keeps me trusting in Jesus. Friends, and it is such a great encouragement for us to know that we can indeed cast all of our anxieties onto God because He cares for us. So now Peter, having given us great comfort, tells us to get ready for action. Peter spent much of his letter helping his readers to understand the times in which they live. We've seen Peter tell them about their past, living the way that pagans chose to live, living for human desires, refusing to acknowledge the rule of Jesus. Peter has helped them understand their current reality as aliens and strangers in a foreign land, suffering all kinds of trials because they are followers of Jesus. And he's helped them look on their brilliant future of an inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade, kept for them in heaven. And Peter now helps his readers to live in the present. We need to understand that our current reality, while tough, is only momentary in comparison to the eternity we have living with Jesus. And it's this that helps us to live every day, suffering and maybe even dying for the name of Jesus. But you know what? I think many Christians in Australia are very slow to realise what time they live in. I think they either live in the past, living in their pagan lives, forgetting about Jesus, just living like they did before they became Christians. Or they live in the future, which I think is actually a far greater danger sometimes. Walling themselves off from the world, trying to create heaven on earth, forgetting that this current reality is one of suffering and pain. Now, I read an article recently about a couple in the United States. It was titled, "I've Always Loved the Victorian Era, So I Decided to Live There." Why is this? These stories always seem to come out of the US, don't they? But anyway, not bagging them out or anything. Anyway, this couple who are in their early 20s, like your age, have bought an early 19th century farmhouse and they've restored it. And they live like they're in the 1880s. The first thing they did was, when they bought the house, it was a modern refrigerator, they chucked it out and they found an antique icebox. Now, if you don't know, before there was fridges and electricity, what they used to do used to be a thing that looked like a fridge. Basically a big esky where you put a block of ice in. Your ice was delivered every day. It would take a few days. The ice would keep your stuff cool. Anyway, she's found one of these in an antique shop and bought it. I don't even know where she's getting blocks of ice from. But anyway, she's got ice, and that's keeping her food cold. She's got a mechanical clock she winds every day. She's got an antique fountain pen that she trims the wick of and does all that stuff. And since the electric light had been invented in the late 1800s, she uses an electric light, but only bulbs designed by Edison, the guy who invented the electric light. This couple are living in the past, aren't they? You see, to live properly, you need to understand the times in which you live. To live in any other time is to live in fantasy land. Peter doesn't want his readers to go back to their pagan past or get too excited and try to make heaven on earth. But rather, he wants them to know what their present looks like and that it looks like living as aliens and strangers in a hostile world. You see, friends, it is dangerous to live in fantasy land. It's dangerous to not see the real hazards around you. And Peter wants his readers to know that there are indeed very real dangers in this present age. Have a look at verse 8. "Be sober, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, is prowling around like a roaring lion, looking for anyone he can devour." Now, it's interesting who Peter says his adversary is. I think if you took a straw poll of Peter's readers, they'd probably say the Romans who are persecuting them would be their enemies. They might say that the Jewish religious leaders in the synagogue who are persecuting them are their enemies. They might say that the mobs roaming around killing Christians are their enemies. But no, who does Peter say is their enemy? Who does Peter say is their adversary? The devil. So Peter says that there is a greater enemy than the one who is locking your friends up. A greater enemy than the one who is taking away your stuff. The devil. You see, the devil, he's the one that is looking for someone to devour. He's the one wanting Peter's readers to give up on Jesus. He's the one wanting to take their faith away. To help us understand the very real danger that the devil poses to Christians, Peter uses an illustration of a lion. Now, a lion is a very dangerous creature, one who can prowl around very quietly and pounce when least expected. That is how Peter describes the devil. Notice that the devil is looking for someone to devour. Now, I don't know a lot about lions, but apparently they're opportunistic hunters. They're looking for creatures or people who are vulnerable. So can I encourage you to do your best not to be vulnerable? What does this look like? Well, watch out for what you read and what you watch on TV. Have a look at what you drink and what you put into your bodies. Who do you spend time with? Who do you date? That is, just by way of an aside, the way I've seen most Christian young people walk away from Jesus is by going out with a non-Christian. That is a way of making it. It's like covering yourself in like raw meat and just waiting for a lion. Like, that is just ridiculously making yourself vulnerable. You see, we need to recognize the serious danger that we're in. Now, if I don't know if there's a PA system in here, but if it came across a PA system that a lion had escaped at uni, I don't know why a lion would be at uni, but let's just say that there was a lion and it escaped. Do you think you'd go out there and walk around by yourself? Do you think you'd walk between the Hunter side and the Shortland side of the uni? I mean, I feel like I'm going to get eaten by a bear there anyway, so it feels so remote. You'd be wanting an armed escort, wouldn't you? You wouldn't be walking around by yourself. And that's the kind of a level of alert we need to have. We need to be serious and alert about the devil. But we do need to strike a balance here. We can't be terrified of the devil. We need to be alert but not alarmed, recognizing that the devil is a defeated enemy, that Jesus has defeated him at the cross. But it's silly to go around walk around covered in like raw meat, isn't it? You don't want to make yourself vulnerable to him. So how should we deal with the devil? Well, have a look at verse 9 with me. Verse 9. Resist him and be firm in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are being experienced by your fellow believers throughout the world. He tells us to resist the devil and be firm in our faith. We are to resist the devil by continuing to trust God, by casting all of our anxieties onto him because he cares for us. We don't need to worry about God being in control because we know that he is. Now, that doesn't mean that everything's going to come out the way you want it to come out. It doesn't mean that you're going to get to marry the one that you want to marry. It doesn't mean that you're going to get the job that you want to get. But we can trust God that he has got the big picture of what is happening in the universe under control. We need to trust God. That's the first way of resisting the devil. The second way we are to resist the devil is to have solidarity with other Christians. Remembering that we're not the only ones going through this. We're not the only ones struggling with being Christians in a world that hates Jesus. There are lots of other brothers and sisters alive today, and indeed throughout history, who have suffered even worse fates than us. And we can find solidarity with them in our suffering. And the church is also a great place of community and solidarity. So close that in the last verse of 1 Peter, verse 14, Peter encourages his readers to greet each other with a kiss of love. Wow, a kiss of love. Who does that at church, on the door at church, anyone? It's pretty bad that both people with their hands up go to my church. But this isn't a romantic kiss. This is a kiss of brotherly love, a kiss of solidarity. How much easier would it be to face suffering when you are part of a united front, a close and loving church? So, one so close that you get to greet each other with a kiss of love. So can I encourage each of you to work hard at your relationships with church? Can I encourage each of you to work hard at your relationships with NCS? Love each other deeply in a true self-sacrificial way. It's important, and it's not just important for, you know, it's nice to be part of a close community, but it's important to resist the devil, to have that solidarity. So Peter now draws his letter to a close with some of the most amazing words, I think, in the Bible. Have a look at verse 10 to 11 with me. Now the God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ Jesus, will personally restore and establish, strengthen and support you after you have suffered a little while. To him be dominion forever. Amen. And hasn't this been the main thrust of Peter's letter? that while we live in the present being strangers in a strange land, while in the present we are to suffer for Jesus, it isn't the present that is to captivate us. We're not to be captivated by the here and now. We are to be captivated by heaven. We are to be captivated by our future. As Christians, we are fundamentally to be future-orientated people, focusing not on our suffering, which only lasts for a little while. A suffering, though, which God promises to keep us going, will only last for a short time before we get to enjoy eternity with him forever. It's only a short time before we get to gain our inheritance kept for us in heaven that can never perish, spoil, or fade. So when you are suffering for being a Christian, when people mock you, mock your belief being a Christian. In fact, just then, about half an hour ago, I was sitting in a cafe looking at my talk, and I overheard a couple of girls bagging out one of their Christian friends for getting married when she was 21. Just then. Your non-Christian friends are going to mock you. It's going to happen. We're going to suffer for being a Christian. But when that happens, trust God. Have faith in him, knowing that you're a part of the universal church, just stretching throughout time and space. And find comfort, real comfort, not in your current reality, but looking towards your glorious future as a believer of Jesus. So as we finish this talk, and indeed this series in 1 Peter, can I ask you, are you ready? Are you alert? Are you ready for the serious task of standing up for Jesus in a world that hates him and hates you? Are you ready to suffer and die for Jesus, humbly submitting yourself to God's care? Are you ready to step up into leadership in God's church? Are you ready to step up in humility to follow good and godly leaders? Are you ready for a lifetime of ministry, being self-controlled, watching out for the devil who prowls around like a roaring lion? Are you ready? Well, I hope you are. Because living the Christian life is far more like a war than a game. In the Christian life, we play with live ammo, the gospel, and we are in real spiritual danger. But that's okay because God is in control. He is the one, Peter says, who has dominion, who has authority, who has power. And I can think of no better way to finish this talk and indeed this series on 1 Peter than to read verses 10 to 11 again. Now the God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ Jesus, will personally restore, establish, strengthen, and support you after you have suffered a little while. To him be the dominion forever.